Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 12, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, polar lightning on Jupiter, politicians advising doctors on health issues, the neurobiology of itch, and the experiences of minorities in science. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The New Horizons probe, which is headed for the outer reaches of our solar system, swung by Jupiter earlier this year and had a good look at the giant planet. Among the many things scientists saw there...
Well, we discovered lightning on the poles of Jupiter, on both poles, and we find then that the degree of lightning activity is the same as elsewhere on the planet.
Kevin Baines is lead author of a paper in this week's Science on this discovery. A discovery that links Earth and Jupiter, as polar lightning had only been seen before here on Earth. I spoke with Baines from the American Astronomical Society meeting going on this week in Orlando, Florida. So put this into context for me. Does this observation of lightning on the poles help increase our understanding of Jupiter, or is there a bigger picture here?
Oh, it does help us increase our understanding of Jupiter and probably all the other outer planets as well. There's an outstanding problem with Jupiter in that we expected, theoretically, to see lightning at the poles, but all previous spacecraft never saw it. Voyager didn't see it, Cassini didn't see it, Galileo didn't see it. So it led to some suspicion that our theory was wrong. But now that we've seen the lightning with New Horizons, we now know we can, you know, breathe a sigh of relief and be assured, well, relatively assured that our models about how we expect Jupiter to behave are right. And what it really means is that Jupiter is very active, and it's active all the way up to the poles. Jupiter has this unique aspect compared to Earth that has a lot of internal energy trying to get out. It's hotter than it should be, and there's an energy source inside that's putting out energy, and we need to get that energy relieved, and it has to come out somewhere. And there's no reason to suspect that energy is going to come out at the equator, preferentially to the polar regions. And so we expected always to see this energy trying to get out both at the poles and the equator. So seeing it now is a sigh of relief that the energy is trying to get out all over the planet, not just in one spot.
How's that compared to the other planets?
The other planets have the same thing. Saturn and Neptune in particular also have internal heat sources, and so we hope someday to see lightning in those planets and be able to see that it is coming out of both poles as well. The same kind of lightning at the poles as at the equator, and you can basically then show that the dynamics of the planet are basically uniform across the planet, and that one latitude is more susceptible to upwelling radiation and energy than anywhere else. So hopefully we'll see that someday. But right now we've got Jupiter.
Is Jupiter somehow easier than seeing the other planets?
Jupiter is easier to do the study with. You can see lightning easier on Jupiter because the water level in the atmosphere isn't as deep as it is on Saturn. And on Neptune, when you have cold planets, then the place you have to go down to get warm enough to have liquid water where you can then have lightning, that's way deep on those planets. And we're talking hundreds of kilometers down in some cases. And so Jupiter is relatively easy because you need to only go down about 50 kilometers below the ammonia clouds. That's the first clouds in the atmosphere. Only need to go 50 kilometers down below that level to get to the point where you have room temperature and water ice and water clouds. And so you can then, that's what a lightning would be. So we're just encouraged now that we finally, at least on one of these outer planets, have seen that there's lightning at both the poles and elsewhere on the planet. And so the lightning is pretty uniform across the planet.
Where do you see most lightning on Earth, and why? And why is that different than what you see on Jupiter?
Yeah, well, on Earth, you can imagine, to get lightning to happen, you need vertical dynamics. You need upwelling of air, which takes with it water-laden, moist air with it. And it's the moist air that's condensing out into cloud particles that then gives rise to lightning. And it's a very complicated sort of phenomena, but as you get water and ice coming out, you can get polarization going on in different particles. And the theory is that ice has preferentially has one type of charge and water has the other type of charge. And so now you can get lightning to strike from particle to particle, basically separate the charges, and you can get different levels in the clouds. The ice level versus the water level in the clouds have different charges, and then you can get lightning to happen. But you need water. So of course, at the equator of the Earth, we have a lot of sunlight. The atmosphere heats up, and now that atmosphere can hold a lot more water. So it can hold a lot more of the fuel that creates lightning and that creates thunderstorms. And so as you rise, that moist and laden air upward near the equator, it holds so much more water fuel that then you can really, you know, cause a big bang as it comes up and starts condensing into clouds, and then it can self-propel itself basically up even higher, so then you get this separation of charges over a large extent of atmosphere. So over the Earth, we see that over the equator, you get a lot more lightning than elsewhere. In fact, it kind of diminishes uniformly from the equator up to the pole. And near the pole, let's say at 60 degrees latitude, you get only about 10% of the lightning that you get at the equator. So, and it's a pretty uniform kind of distribution. By the way, it does seem to move a little bit with the seasons, and so you can tell the effect of summer versus winter and things. So where the sun's shining really hot and, you know, warms up the air, and where it can hold a lot of water, that's where you get the most abundant lightning on the Earth.
And on Jupiter?
On Jupiter, because it has so much internal energy trying to get out, the primary source of power in warming the atmosphere down at the 5-bar level, way below the clouds that we see from the Earth, and clouds basically up high basically reflect back a lot of light from the sun. So it's very, you know, relatively little light from the sun is getting down below the 1-bar level, and yet it's got this internal heat which equals the power of the sun inside Jupiter. And so basically Jupiter is a different animal. It basically heats from below because of its internal heat, not because of sunlight coming down. And so that heating from below should be pretty uniform across the planet. And that's the difference. So we expected then that lightning should be pretty uniform across the planet, because there aren't these variations in humidity either, and there's no variation in the energy inbound.
So with the Jupiter understanding then is that it's emitting heat from inside in every direction, and therefore, because it has water presumably in at every latitude, that's the reason why you're expecting to see uniform lightning over the entire planet.
Exactly. That's what it is. And so what this is encouraging, because nobody had any explanation for why the planet should be, let's say, dramatically different from the equator to the pole. Now, we do expect a little bit of difference. It turns out that Jupiter it seems to have its own thermostat inside the planet. So if you go to the pole, you find the same temperatures as you do at the equator. And since the sun is delivering sun energy at the equator, that means that the pole, to make up for that deficit of sunlight, there's a little bit more internal heat that gets out. So there are some people out there who believe that there should be even more lightning at the poles than at the equator, because it's being propelled from below, being warmed up from below. At the 5-bar level, you ought to be able to have a little more of the heat trying to get out. So some people believe that you should have a little bit more dynamicism up at the poles. But it's you know, that's probably a relatively minor effect. I mean, but up until now, having seen none, you know, that was a dramatically different result than what we expected from the theory, and so it's been, you know, it's a good thing now that we kind of resolved it and we actually do see the lightning now that people expected to see.
Okay, so what does this mean for the next either probe or further along this research path? Where do you go from here?
Well, I would think the next thing would be actually to see if the same thing holds true on Saturn. But Saturn, we have the Cassini mission in orbit about Saturn right now. But again, it's much harder to see down into it. So I'm not sure if we'll have much luck in actually seeing if we have the same kind of evidence of vertical dynamics in Saturn using this technique, using lightning as a tracer of dynamics. Now, there is a new mission going to Jupiter in 3 or 4 years. That's called Juno, and it will be in a polar orbit, and it will get information about the poles we haven't had before. And it's actually got the means to really look deep into the planet by measuring gravity and by measuring magnetic fields. And so that mission actually could help us a lot understand the interior of Jupiter, which is all part and parcel of this that we're trying to understand here. In this study, we're trying to get a link to the deep interior and how energy is coming out from the interior. This new mission will actually map out the kinds of densities of gases and different kind of maybe deep meteorological features that might be deep down there. It's going to be a mission of discovery in that respect, trying to find gigantic regional types of formations that might be down there with pressure and density changes. So it's going to be a very interesting mission, especially you can imagine looking at the red spot, trying to see what's underneath that red spot in this new mission that will be there probably around 2011, I believe, would perhaps help us understand as well what's going on with this vertical dynamics of the planet, particularly in these major weather features like the Great Red Spot.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and good luck with the future paths, especially with Juno coming up.
Yes, well, thank you.
Kevin Baines is lead author of a paper on polar lightning on Jupiter. You can learn more about the data gathered from the New Horizons flyby of Jupiter in several papers in a special section of this week's Science. Other space news and science this week, a weather report from Saturn's moon, Titan. Matei Adamkiewicz and colleagues have detected widespread morning drizzle on this distant moon. But it's not water raining down, it's methane. Using near-infrared spectra from the Very Large Telescope and Keck observatories, the team obtained a new view of Titan's lower atmosphere and surface. With the underlying geography of the moon, the researchers suggest that the drizzle completes the methane cycle, perhaps similar to the water cycle here on Earth. Read the paper, Widespread Morning Drizzle on Titan, published online this week at www.scienceexpress.org.
The Surgeon General of the United States needs help.
Fitzhugh Mullen is a former Assistant Surgeon General.
Modern holders of the office of Surgeon General are tightly constrained by the increasingly politicized environment of Washington. This past July, three former United States Surgeons General sat before Congress and detailed a rising tide of political interference in their work. Richard Carmona, for example, who stepped down last year, told of being blocked from speaking out on issues such as stem cell research and emergency contraception. He also said he was instructed to reference President Bush three times on every page of every speech he gave. But the problems for the Surgeon General are not limited to the current Republican administration. David Satcher, who served in the office under President Clinton, a Democrat, recounted to Congress the interference with his report on sexuality and public health, in part because of the Monica Lewinsky affair. And C. Everett Koop, under the Reagan administration, described attempts of political staff to thwart his AIDS campaign. That July hearing before Congress raised questions not just about political interference with science, but about the Surgeon Generalship itself. While the office was established in 1889 as the Surgeon General of the Marine Hospital Service, a precursor of today's public health service, federal public health grew rapidly over the half century following the creation of the job. By 1960, the Surgeon General oversaw a small empire of federal health programs, including the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Indian Health Service. But in 1967, Lyndon Johnson appointed an Assistant Secretary for Health with authority over the Public Health Service and the Surgeon General, effectively making the job of Surgeon General largely ceremonial. The next president, Richard Nixon, did not even appoint a Surgeon General in his second term. C. Everett Koop brought the position back to the fore through the strength of his personality and the exploding AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and a hands-off policy from President Reagan. Currently, the position is ill-defined, budgetless, and subject to the agendas of a variety of political appointees. The Surgeon Generalship can and should be much more. It should and can be the nation's family doctor, an ombudsman for the health of all of us. Congress needs to act. The Surgeon Generalship should be a protected position. The Surgeon General should be required to publish an annual report on the nation's health and have a budget to do the work of the office. And finally, the Surgeon General must be able to speak and write based on science and medicine without political interference. Our nation's health deserves no less. I'm Fitzhugh Mullen.
Fitzhugh Mullen is a professor of health policy and pediatrics at George Washington University and is a former assistant surgeon general. Read his editorial, Plight of the Surgeon General, in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, a common ancestor of plants and animals. Sabiha Merchant and colleagues have found that the single-celled algae, Chlamydomonas reinhardti, shares some features with animal cells. By comparing known genomes with that of the green algae, the team found that this model system for studying photosynthesis retains genes and shares features with animal cells for movement, including flagella and cilia. Read the paper, The Chlamydomonas Genome Reveals the Evolution of Key Animal and Plant Functions, in this week's Science. If you've got an itch, you scratch it, right? But what if scratching it didn't make the itch go away? In this week's Science, news writer Greg Miller reports on chronic itch. I spoke to him from San Francisco, where he recently attended a meeting of the world's experts on itch.
There was one really disturbing case study presented at the meeting. I was actually able to contact this patient and talk to her about her experience, which has been a really terrible ordeal. She, a few years ago, about 9 years ago, developed a case of shingles, which is a resurgence of the virus that causes chickenpox, and it caused a painful rash, mostly on her face on the right side. And her doctors gave her antiviral drugs that cleared up the rash and the pain from the rash. But when that happened, an itch took the place of the pain, and it was just an incredible, infuriating itch. And she scratched it, as it's hard to avoid scratching an itch. But she scratched it so much that over the course of a year, she actually wore through the skin on her forehead and damaged her skull. The bone became infected and soft, and she, still not realizing the damage she was causing, kept scratching and eventually weakened her skull so much that her right frontal lobe of her brain herniated through a hole, essentially, that she created in her skull. And she ended up in the emergency room, and doctors had to remove a small part of her brain to be able to patch up the wound.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just infuriating itch, and she still to this day lives with it. Nothing has really been able to help her. She had an operation to cut a nerve in hopes that would cut off the itch, but it hasn't really worked. And she uses a local anesthetic, patches sort of a cloth soaked with local anesthetic to put on the affected area. And she says that takes the edge off the itch, but it's still really there. It's not going away or not getting much better at all. So that's a really extreme example of someone who's just had a miserable experience with chronic itch.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Wow. Now, chronic itch, how widespread is this? How many people are suffering?
Well, there was a researcher from Wake Forest University who, in his talk, gave just a slew of statistics from recent studies. There was one published last year that found that 300 million people worldwide suffer from scabies, which is a skin condition. There are a lot of them that are skin conditions, but there are also itch associated with kidney disease and liver disease and even HIV infections. So it's a very common companion to a lot of other diseases, which I hadn't realized.
And how does this chronic itch differ from itch you say, you know, might get from a mosquito bite?
Well, the main thing is it just doesn't go away. It's sort of constant. And biologically, one thing that seems to be different is that the itch you get from a mosquito bite or poison ivy or something like that is mediated by histamine. And you can get relief by taking antihistamine drugs. But for most of the chronic itch conditions, antihistamine drugs don't work very well at all. And so that's a real puzzle for the field. It seems to imply that there must be molecular mechanisms other than histamine that are involved in these chronic itch conditions, but what they are is not very clear at all right now.
So scientists haven't identified really what causes it?
No, they really don't know very much at all about what causes it, how itch is transmitted by the nervous systems. They don't know very much about how to treat it. I mean, there's a lot of work going on to try to understand those things, but right now it's very puzzling and very frustrating for the clinicians and for the patients who have chronic itch, of course.
Why do we itch in the first place?
Well, I asked that question to a number of researchers because, right, if itch is so problematic, why do we have it? And a lot of them think that the reason itch evolved in the first place is to protect us against insects and their bites and them laying eggs or burrowing into our skin or that sort of thing. Because if you think about your response to itch, itch sort of draws attention to an area of your skin and causes you to scratch at it, which might be good for dislodging the insects or anything they leave behind. So that's a little bit speculative, but that's what a lot of people think is the reason we have itch.
Scratching an itch does feel pretty good. Are any scientists tapping into that method of treating an itch?
Well, some of them are looking at what happens in the nervous system when an itch is scratched. There were a couple of studies there by some neuroscientists at the University of Minnesota who have been looking in monkeys at how scratching an itchy area of the skin affects the firing rate of neurons in the spinal cord that are important for transmitting itch signals to the brain. And they found that scratching sort of shuts those neurons up for just a little bit. And there are other researchers are using brain imaging methods to look in the human brain of healthy people and also people with chronic itch conditions to try to figure out what parts of the brain are activated during itchiness and during scratching. And they also see some effects where scratching dampens activity in some of the parts of the brain that are involved in processing itch.
Is the scratching itself addictive in some way? People are getting kind of a high off of scratching themselves?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's certainly just from practical experience. It does often feel really good to scratch an itch, and sometimes it even feels good to scratch when you don't have an itch. Like if someone scratches your back, sometimes that's enjoyable. And so there does seem to be a rewarding quality to the scratch itself. There are a lot of things about itch that researchers really don't understand. It seems to be contagious to some extent. There was a study a few years ago where German researchers videotaped volunteers while they listened to a lecture about itch, and they found them scratching much more than they did when they were listening to some other kind of presentation, suggesting that just even hearing about itch or thinking about itch can make you scratch.
So people listening to this podcast might be scratching a little more often than they normally would be?
They may be.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for sharing this article with us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Science News writer Greg Miller reports on the neurobiology of itch. Read more about it in this week's Science. Ethnicity, culture, age, gender, disability. There are many ways to slice up the term minority group. But what is clear is that individuals characterized as minorities rarely, if ever, fit a minority stereotype. Instead, it's that stereotyping itself that can lead to some unusual experiences, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. Some of those unusual experiences are chronicled in a special feature this week on Science's online job and career building site, Science Careers. Here are a few of those stories narrated by Mycella Phoenix DeWise, the author of the site's popular Educated Woman column.
Imagine you're just starting your graduate program in a scientific, technological, engineering, or mathematical discipline. You look around at all the other students, and it is obvious that you're physically different from everyone else. Now imagine, it's after class, and you're in line to ask the professor a question.
And when it's my turn to ask her a question, she bypasses me and goes to my white male counterpart behind me and asked him what question he had.
Rita Thornton is a section chief in the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in the United States.
And I looked at her and I said, whoa, excuse me, did I fade away into the wall? Oh, I'm sorry, Rita, I didn't see you. Oh, only blacks are in the class. You didn't see me?
Rita Thornton, who got her doctorate last year, eventually figured out one reason why she was being overlooked. She says her professor had a certain viewpoint.
You people don't do well in science and math. You know, I'm not saying anything that cannot be backed up with statistics. You people just don't do well in science and math. And she really, truly did not think she said anything offensive. And I looked at the faculty member. This is 2001, I'm saying. What do you mean, you people?
Discrimination happens for a variety of reasons. But Maki Koyama learned that just being polite, as is the custom in Japan, was giving her problems in the United Kingdom.
To be polite in Japanese way doesn't seem to work efficiently. Some maybe English researchers just take it as maybe not assertive. So if I want to do something properly, sometimes I have to articulate what I want rather than being polite. Otherwise, it would cause such a misunderstanding in communication, and it could really prevent me or Japanese people from getting across whatever I want to say in a science.
Koyama's experience shows that it isn't always clear why minorities may be treated differently. But she says it would have been nice to have some support programs beyond what she got from her faculty advisors. Even having done both her undergraduate and graduate programs in the United Kingdom, she's never experienced such support.
So I wonder whether there is, you know, very clear systematic support for ethnic minority in this country in terms of science. I have no idea.
But Saad Javabdi, originally from Morocco, said it was very easy to transition to France for his studies because of the similarities in the two educational systems.
In this engineering school where I was, there were 10 places for Morocco, Tunisia, and Lebanon. So there are not many places, but still, it's a direct route. Once you succeed in the exam to go there, then you can study with some sort of peace of mind.
That peace of mind, though, did not extend to Jababdi's experience outside of school. After 7 years in France, he's moved to the United Kingdom.
In France, I was feeling a bit awkward. with people in the subway or in the streets. But France is still quite open-minded compared to other countries. I can speak about Morocco, for example, because I come from there, and I know that sub-Saharan Africans have quite a hard time in Morocco, in universities, and so when you're black, basically, in Morocco, it's like people are not very nice to you. So France is much better, but England is even better than France.
The reason many people leave their home country and become a minority in another country may be for scientific opportunities. Nerfilza Ahmad took those opportunities twice, once to the United States for her bachelor's degree, and the second time for her doctorate in the United Kingdom. For her master's, Ahmad did that at home in Malaysia.
It was originally supposed to be a two-year program, but yeah, there was a lot of problems with intrinsic problems within the project itself, and also administrative problems, and sometimes it takes a long time for you to get chemicals or your orders, you know, in. I wasn't the only one taking 5 years for my master's. There's some who took like 8 or 10 years, even due to, you know, a lot of different circumstances.
Such programs abroad are often supported by the student's home government. Ahmad says that such support is an advantage, but it made her feel a little uncertain about why she was there.
Well, my last supervisor would probably not agree, but I kept telling him that he took me in only because I brought in £10,000 to the lab per year, because that came with my scholarship. So although I didn't get a lot in the way of allowances per month, I do bring in quite a lot of bench fees to the lab. And that was sort of a huge attraction for people to take me in to their labs.
All the people in the story are still working in their scientific field. They didn't stop just because of the obstacles placed in front of them or leave because of what appeared to be a negative bias related to the perceived advantage of the minority status. Again, Nafilza Ahmad.
The career path is nowhere solid, nowhere near solid in any way in science. And I realized this, of course, before I decided to stay, because if I'd gone home, I would have got this permanent job. But I threw that all that away just so that I could stay here where I know I can do proper work, even though it is risky and even though the career path is not as clear-cut. But I guess it's all part of the game, isn't it? Happiness is quite important, I think, to some people.
For those facing minority discrimination, either abroad or at home, Rita Thornton advises valuing those who do give you support, including faculty, friends, and family. Thornton says her sister helped her decide to go for it.
You realize I'm going to be over 50 years old by the time I graduate. And she goes, Rita, you're going to be over 50 anyway, so why not be over 50 with a doctorate degree? Oh, never thought of it that way. Now I'm over 50 with a doctorate degree.
For the Science Podcast, I'm Mycella Phoenix-DeWise.
You can read more about each of these interviewees, as well as check out the regular posts by Mycella Phoenix-DeWise at sciencecareers.sciencemag.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. So David, what do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, today we're going to talk a little bit about the Ig Nobels, which are the sort of funny version of the real Nobels. They've been around, this is their 17th year, and they are meant to highlight research that is funny, odd, or just downright questionable.
Now, the Ig Nobels, are there real science experiments that have happened that people are getting these prizes for?
Yeah, this is all real science. This is all research that in many occasions has been published in real scientific journals. It's just a little odd.
Okay, so what were the Ig Nobels this year?
Well, every year they give out about 10 awards. I won't go through all of them, but I'll share with you some of the highlights. For example, the Ig Nobel Prize in Chemistry went to a researcher, a Japanese researcher, who extracted vanillin, which is the flavor you taste in vanilla ice cream, from cow dung. Exactly. And actually more ooh was that apparently at the conference they actually had ice cream made from the vanillin this researcher extracted, and apparently quite a few people ate it. So even more ooh.
I guess you can get chemicals from just about anything. I mean, there are stories of makeup being made from bat guano, right?
That's news to me, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
So what were some of the other ones?
Well, the Medicine Prize went to a group of researchers, actually one researcher who's a radiologist and an entertainer, quite an unlikely pairing, for measuring the effects of sword swallowing. And perhaps not surprisingly, sword swallowing appears to be affiliated with sore throats and gastrointestinal bleeding. So the Medicine Prize for that.
No kidding. Sword swallowing causing bleeding and sore throats. Okay.
Makes you wonder who funded this kind of research, but somebody's funding it. Okay, and then we've got the Physics Prize for people who are trying to figure out why bed sheets wrinkle.
I thought that was just because you rolled around on them.
These are questions I didn't even know were being asked, but apparently they're being answered. And then we've got the Aviation Prize. We're from a group of researchers that showed that Viagra can help hamsters get their circadian rhythms back on track.
Now, I heard about this one, that we were supposed to take Viagra ourselves when we got off of airplanes, and that would sort of keep us from getting jet lag.
Well, there's an Ig Nobel in it. I don't know how relevant it is, but it's certainly an interesting study. Anytime you have Viagra in a study, I think it's bound to raise eyebrows.
Or other things, right?
Exactly. I didn't want to go there, but thank you, Rob, for doing that.
My pleasure.
So then we're moving on to the Linguistics Prize, where our researchers in Spain showed that rats can't tell the difference between Dutch and Japanese when it's spoken backwards.
I don't think I could either.
I don't think I could either. What exactly this study tells us, I have no idea. And finally, one of the highlights was the Economics Ig Nobel, which went to a Taiwanese researcher. I'm not even sure he's a researcher, but he filed a U.S. patent which proposes using a net to capture bank robbers.
Kind of old technique, isn't it?
Indeed, and apparently he didn't show up for the ceremonies.
Why was that? Is he still tangled up in his own net or something?
Possibly.
So have you got any other stories about science this week that may belong in the Ig Nobel Awards next year?
Well, interestingly, a story we ran on the same day fits in very nicely with the Ig Nobels, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was mentioned or at least honored at next year's ceremony. And this has to do with lap dancers earning bigger tips when they're at different phases of their estrus cycle.
Now, I always thought that you couldn't tell, that it was somehow hidden. I mean, not like dogs or baboons, which clearly show that they're in heat.
Right. And that's actually something that's well known in humans, is that women don't display when they're in quote unquote heat. And this apparently evolved in evolutionarily so that women could keep men in the dark in terms of keeping them around longer, so they weren't just around for mating. So yeah, researchers really don't believe that women display any sort of different signals when they're in the most fertile phase of their estrus cycle as compared to other animals like baboons.
But these researchers were able to find something out looking at strippers?
Yes, so it's an interesting model system, but they think they found a clue. And here's what they did. They signed up 18 lap dancers from local clubs. And Rob, neither you or I know what a lap dance is, but I'll describe it to the audience. And this is basically where a woman, a stripper, does a dance, a sexual-oriented dance on a man's lap, usually for about 5 or 10 minutes. And they're typically tipped at the end of the dance. The average in this study was about $14 per lap dance.
Thank you for explaining that, Dave.
My pleasure, Rob. And so what the researchers did in this study is they took 18 lap dancers, 18 strippers, and they asked them to record what phase of their cycle they were in and what tips they were getting during those phases. And what was really surprising was that they found that the women that were in the most fertile phase of their estrous cycle earned about $70 an hour, a lot of that coming from lap dances, tips from lap dances, versus the women that were in the least fertile phase only earned about $35 an hour, so half as much. So somehow, the researchers say, the men that were getting the lap dances were able to pick up on which women were most fertile and tipped them accordingly.
Is double the price really statistically significant? I mean, how many of these lap dances total were happening?
Well, they actually had recorded 5,300 lap dances. So we're talking about pretty big numbers here. And it was over a 60-day period. So definitely seems to be a well-designed trial with high numbers.
So what do the researchers think is driving it?
Well, I think the jury's still out on that. Some experts have speculated that it's something in a woman's body motion, that somehow they move their bodies differently, and this is something that men subconsciously pick up on.
So there's something about the estrogen cycle that changes the way they move or dance?
Well, that's what one researcher, one outside researcher, an expert in this sort of thing suggests. He says that it's possible that estrogen actually modulates the way that women move. And when they move differently, this is something that men pick up on and tip accordingly.
Generating higher tips and greater wages, okay.
But exactly why these men are tipping more, I think, is still an open question. It's unclear exactly what they think they're going to get. If they know the women are more fertile, maybe they're anticipating sex. Who knows? I'll leave it up to this team to do that research.
And the Ig Nobel Committee to decide whether to award it.
Exactly.
Okay, Dave. Well, I guess we'll be seeing the real Nobels on the site this week. Is that right?
That's correct. We've already posted stories on the Physics Nobel and the Medicine Nobel. And check back frequently for updates and stories on all the other Nobels that are being announced over the next week.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the October 12, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.